management, or other sponsors.
To Edge Thursday Report. My name is Andy Radford and this is the Edge's UK studio. On the show this week, the language of God in history, the language of God in prophecy. Author Helen Lehman joins us in an Edge talkback discussion later on in the show with my co-host Roderick Purser. If you watched Daniel Ott's live show last Saturday, Helen was a guest on his show. Also on the show, regular contributor to the Edge Thursday Reports, Dr. Frederick Meekins has given us a report entitled Environmentalism Not About the Earth, But About Control. Also on the show, Toxic Waste on Publicly Used Land. Before we go into this, just the regular reminders about the Edge website and the services and activities it has to offer you, the viewer and listener. We have a forum, a pretty good forum at that. And we don't mind if you agree or disagree with the guest or the host on this forum. All we are looking for is intellectual comment and discussion about the genres the Edge broadcast covers. Don't forget we have an absolute brand new web store full of books, DVDs and lots of other goods for you to browse and purchase. Helen's books, incidentally, are available on this store and links to these books can be found on the Edge Thursday Reports program notes on the UK studio page at www.theedgeam.com. Just click the UK studio link on any of the pages. Also, the store link can be found on any of the pages also. Just go again to www.theedgeam.com and you will see our Edge store link. And if you do use Amazon to purchase your goods online, CDs, DVDs, books or anything, please go through our Edge store because we get a commission from Amazon every time we have a sale. And this commission goes to our hefty bandwidth costs and also helps us to research new material and invest in new technology. For you, the viewer and listener, we want to keep the Edge TV broadcast right up there in front of our genre. And while being at the forefront of our genre, we also want to keep the Edge TV broadcast free for you, the viewer and listener. All shows are free. All single show archives are free. There is no charge on the Edge website. You might find the odd donation link. If you want to donate, please donate. You will be helping, again, towards the cost of technology, research, and our bandwidth. But that is not a criteria to enjoy the Edge TV broadcast and all the shows and affiliate shows we have to offer. Why not take a look at EdgeTube at www.edgetube.net. That's edgetube.net, or you can click the link from any of the Edge TV broadcast website. This will take you directly to EdgeTube. Here, you can upload your own video, you can embed video from YouTube, Google, or any video sharing site that gives you an embed code. And like the rest of the activities on the Edge TV broadcast, this is absolutely free. You can also record your own presentation for use on Daniel Lott's live show or Edge Thursday Reports, the UK Studios Thursday Reports. There's a link to recording your own video broadcast on the Edges website. You will find that on every page. Just go to www.theedgeam.com. You don't have to record video, you can also record audio only. Don't forget, the Edge Thursday show is the show for the viewer and listener. And if you do have any presentations, any news, any information, any interesting stories you want to give to the Edge viewer, just get in touch with me, Andy at theedgeam.com. That's Andy at theedgeam.com. We will play your presentation and information on the Edge TV broadcast. You can also become a voluntary Edge correspondent. Get in touch with me, Andy, at theedgeam.com for more information on this, or click the reporters link on any page of the Edge's website at www.theedgeam.com. That's for voluntary Edge correspondents. And if all that wasn't enough for you, we even have a collection of our own affiliate shows. You can find these shows by clicking the Other Shows link on any page of the Edge's website. Just hover your mouse over this and you'll see Frank DeMora's Last Chronicles of Planet Earth. You'll see Strange Times. You'll see a show from Gina Romano. And of course, don't forget Daniel Ott's live show, which goes out every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Coming up after this break, Toxic Waste on Publicly Used Land, a short and exclusive Edge special report about the sudden appearance of toxic waste, with the possible culprit being Monsanto in North Wales. And directly after that, Edge viewer submission by regular contributor Dr. Frederick Meekins, entitled Environmentalism, Not About the Earth, But About Control. We'll be right back after this break. Since 1910, Monsanto Chemical Corporation have owned a chemical plant in the North Wales village of Cefnmawr. This chemical plant was Monsanto's first step into multinational corporatism, their very first international factory. Before this, their operations were in the United States of America at St. Louis, where today it is their head office. People became more environmentally aware in the late 1960s and early 1970s, due to the publication of a book called Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. Silent Spring allowed people to question the ethics of chemical production. From the point of publication up until this day, citizens have been more environmentally aware, and this is reflected in today's stronger environmental constraints on polluting companies and where they should dump or how they can dump their toxic waste. The law, of course, still leans heavily with the corporate polluter, as many corporate polluting companies, shareholders and CEOs have links with governments around the world. Having said this, corporate polluters do have to deal with their toxic waste in an environmentally sound manner, and most countries' environmental laws reflect this. But what of the situation before Rachel Carson's Silent Spring? What of the situation before the citizen in the street became more environmentally aware? And what of the situation before these environmental constraints came into being? Toxic waste was dumped before that. Toxic waste was actually dumped anywhere a company could actually find a hole. And this small Edge report is about one such place where the Monsanto chemical plant, now called Flexes, who are still owned by the Monsanto chemical company, dumped toxic waste on a popular walking site near the River Dee in a place called the Dolith, which is a Welsh word for the meadow. It's an area where I walk my dog every day. It is but 1.5 miles from my back door. This winter has been a particularly cold winter. We have in fact had some of the highest snowfalls our area in North Wales have seen, and some of the lowest temperatures. And it's these lowest temperatures that has brought this toxic waste to ground. As you can see from this video footage, which was taken by my cell phone, hence the poorer quality, the water lying on the ground has an oily, filmy mass on top. What you can't experience is the putrid smell. The Monsanto chemical plant, as the crow flies, is less than 1 mile from this exact position. According to one elderly fisherman who brought this case to my attention, remembers when Monsanto dumped this toxic waste. He also told me in recent days a number of dead foxes have been found close to this site. As yet, we don't know what the chemicals are or what chemicals were dumped, but I do know that Monsanto developed all manner of chemicals here in the Kevenmauer plant, including Agent Orange, which is 245T. We have informed the UK Environment Agency of this toxic waste find. As yet, they have not got back to us. We'll keep you updated on the situation as and when we get more information. This has been a brief Edge TV broadcast UK Studios special report on toxic waste here at the Monsanto chemical plant in Kevenmauer.
BBN's UK Studio.
This is Frederick Meekins of the American Worldview Alert. For decades, American motorists have been subjected to propaganda insisting that they either need to drive less or give up safe, comfortable automobiles in favor of what amount to motorized coffins in order to preserve natural resources and environmental quality. Now that this policy goal is pretty much on the road to being implemented, the elites running our lives are not content to sit back in the glow of their accomplishment, but are rather laying the groundwork for the next phase in their grand dream of limiting the free movement of the American people. One would think the increasing popularity of electric and hybrid automobiles would please transportation planners and social engineers. However, as most realize somewhere along life's journey, getting what you want is not always what you expected. For while hybrid cars might cut back on emissions and fuel consumption, they also take a bite out of gas tax revenues. But instead of tightening their belts and learning to make do with less, like as they counsel you when you complain about rising fuel costs, government planners are now conniving to pass the hardship on to you by altering the way transportation taxes are assessed. Currently, such taxes are gathered in about the fairest way possible, a concept seldom associated with taxes, by collecting it in an innocuously private manner from those cautious enough to pay in cash at the pump based upon how many gallons are acquired. However, from a plan being considered in Oregon, motorized Americans will have to contend with another governmental intrusion into their lives of Orwellian proportions. Instead of collecting taxes on each gallon purchased, revenuers plan to install sensors at gas stations capable of reading the global positioning systems to be installed in nearly all vehicles, and from that, tabulating how far a vehicle has been driven or into what zones they have motored. Proponents of the program claim citizens have nothing to fear from Big Brother, since the system would only tabulate mileage rather than specific itinerary. However, one does not have to be a Ray Bradbury to realize what a dystopian road this is headed down. For even if the sensors do not log precise destination, they are still capable of relaying to authorities, even if they are just tax authorities, who can actually make your life more miserable than actual police, as these activist accountants assume greater control over areas of your life once considered beyond the purview of just and legitimate government, such as religious doctrines and where you have been. Even more disturbing, these tracking devices are being designed to catalog at what time of day you drive. That way, the state will be able to charge you an additional fee for daring to drive at the times of day our government slave masters would prefer we stay off the road. While we are at it, why don't they go ahead and add similar devices to our toilets as well, to punish those that have more bowel movements than our betters in government think we ought, since such functions contribute disproportionately to greenhouse emissions and are often a sign that the chronically flocculent might be eating too high up the food chain. Those embracing their place as good little minions of the New World Order will probably respond,
"But this discouragement of motorized travel is legitimate, since one is using roads provided by
the community,
and by definition,
the community
determines what it considers the terms of use."
Those thinking that they will be left alone if they use public transportation and sit quietly in their homes are in for a rude awakening that will probably arrive when they are dragged kicking and screaming to the relocation camp, in part for the sake of the environment. For the totalist state is not content simply to tell you how to live once you step into the broader community. It also wants to tell you in what kind of structure in which you may live out the existence its institutions have been beneficent enough to grant you as well, as in many instances what manner of things you may do once you close the door. Across the pond in merry old England, according to a CNSnews.com story titled, "UK May Tax Environmentally Unfriendly Houses," beatnik rabble in the Green Party there have been at the forefront of efforts to introduce taxes on what their ilk have labeled environmentally damaging behavior. However, such penalties are more than spitting on the sidewalk or tossing litter from the car window. Foremost among these fees include increased property taxes leveled against homes not deemed green enough, as well as on automobiles and on those daring to travel by air. It must be remembered that the power to tax is the power to destroy. One member of the Conservative Party observed, "Such taxes would disproportionately impact the poor and the elderly, since these demographics are more likely to reside in domiciles not meeting energy efficiency expectations." What better way to seize the property of the population's undesirables, namely members of the lower middle class, than to tax them out of their homes and to herd them into governmentally approved relocation compounds, such as those into which Hurricane Katrina victims were shunted? Here, these people were deprived of their constitutional rights to such an extent that they were forbidden from speaking with reporters. One gets around the raw nerve of eminent domain altogether if taxes are raised so high that residents are either forced to sell to developers or to have their property seized by default. Speaking from Tokyo, as the elites will continue their lives of global travel, while the common person will be corralled and branded like cattle going to slaughter, one British legislator, quite a ways from his homeland, I might point out to the geographically illiterate, said, "Sometimes the changes will be painful, but leadership means facing the great challenges, even if the decisions are difficult," end quote. A shame the Eurocrats can't display the same degree of courage to stand against the tide of radical Islam sweeping across what was the cradle of Western civilization. I guess they have no qualms about turning Granny out into the streets, since she isn't likely to strap on a car bomb. Don't be fooled. Those such as the politician above making these kinds of statements won't make a single personal change. Do you honestly believe the likes of Prince Charles and Queen Elizabeth over there and the Bushes, Gores, and Kennedys over here are going to give up their multi-mansion estates to live in some iPod shipping container-sized apartment the rest of us will be expected to live in with a stupid grin slapped across our faces for the sake of the revolution? Not only do the elites plan to snatch your homes from you in the name of conservation, they also want to regulate within your own living space, or rather, the one they plan to assign to you once they have succeeded in placing title to all property in the hands of the state, or whatever institutional arrangement through which they plan to administer relinquished holdings. Speaking before worshipful UN functionaries, Al Gore, whose ballooning waistline and bourgeoning facial jowls indict him for consuming a greater percentage of the Earth's resources than what he would permit the working slob, claimed, according to a September 6, 2006 Drudge report, that cigarettes are a significant contributor to global warming. The same could be said about the former vice president's ever-fattening lip. Drudge ends his dispatch by noting that Gore closed his homily harping on the political future and by hawking a book he had written, no doubt printed on paper that could have contributed more to the cause of Mother Earth if it had remained a tree. Interestingly, Al Gore is not the only eco-pimp using the environment to turn a trick or two. One would think the purpose of an environmental festival would be to discuss the environment. However, from the program printed on the remains of a slaughtered tree, for Green Festival 2006 in Washington, D.C., it seems that the natural world was pretty much tagged on as an afterthought, as the focus seemed to be radical politics, with aging hippies continuing to spread their filth and debauchery. For example, from the schedule of speakers, one wouldn't be surprised to see Karl Marx to show up on the dais, former Mr. Jane Fonda Tom Hayden, who's nearly as old as Marx, was scheduled to speak on the topic of alternatives to war and empire. Activist Medea Benjamin was docketed for the oration titled, "We have the power to stop the war in Iraq." Another scheduled homily was titled, "The Power of Storytelling, Changing the World." What in the name of Sheol does any of this have to do with enjoying nature or marveling at furry woodland creatures? Nothing whatsoever, ladies and gentlemen. But before all this is said and done, those that address such covens will no doubt make those in attendance feel guilty for simply being alive, especially if you happen to be white, and for enjoying the blessings that come from living in the greatest country on earth. And if it wasn't, why are all these immigrants self-loathing liberals want to grant unrestricted access to our bounty keep trying to break in, and perhaps even more importantly, end up forcing you to partake in their life of squalor? Foremost on the agenda was the confiscation of your own individual domicile and privacy. One seminar was titled Community Without Walls. But as one wise soul observed, it might have been Chesterton, don't take down a fence unless you know why it had been put up. Walls and fences, contrary to leftist opinion, are very positive things, as they confirm identity as an individual by demarcating what is mine and what is not mine, namely yours. It is the purpose of such a lecture to erode the concept of individuality in private property by manipulating those in attendance to be an active participant in one's neighborhood, end quote. That may sound all warm and fuzzy, but in a community without walls, where those living have forgotten legitimate boundaries and limitations, it usually ends up being invoked as an excuse to get involved in the business of others that is no one else's concern, and as an excuse to bring sanctions occasionally bordering on the violent against those not opening every detail of their lives to the scrutinizing oversight of the community. Some might conclude that, even if these plans were true, they are so far down the road that we will not have to worry about it during our lifetimes. And even though I cannot give an exact date as to when these communalistic horrors will transpire, when what you slave away for will no longer be yours to enjoy as you wish, but as sure as I draw breath and write this, I can assure you the plans are being set into motion to revolutionize the American way of life. In the future, it won't be enough to let these flakes cordon themselves off in their own compounds, where wacky ideals, loose morals, masculine women, and effeminate men will be the order of the day. As I've said before, it is their intention to drag the rest of us down into their own third world squalor. One of the exhibitors at the Green Festival was the Federation of Egalitarian Communities. The description for this organization reads as follows in the 2006 promotional brochure, quote, "The Federation of Egalitarian Communities is a network of communal groups spread across North America, from small agricultural homesteads to village-like communities to urban group homes," end quote. It has been a few years since the 1960s, so perhaps a few readers, a significant percentage of whom, like myself, didn't even trod the earth at that time, need to be reminded what exactly a commune is. A commune is a living arrangement where the residents do not own their respective domiciles outright, but rather in common with the group, or rather those designated as the representatives of the group, making decisions on behalf of the members. While it may sound all warm and fuzzy, seldom do such living arrangements end happily. At best, most participants part ways with hurt feelings, and at worst, they often end in bloodshed, as typified by the Jonestown and Heaven's Gate tragedies or when the principles are applied society-wide, as in the case of the Soviet Union and Red China. This is Frederick Meekins.
BBN's UK Studio.
Welcome back. You're listening to and watching Edge Thursday Reports, coming to you from the Edge's UK studio. And my name is Andy Radford. And if you, like Frederick Meekins, want to submit an audio presentation or a video presentation for the Edge Thursday Reports, get in touch with me, Andy at theedgeam.com. That's Andy at theedgeam.com. Continuing Edge Thursday Reports, research into 2012 and the Nephilim, author Helena Lehman discusses her findings in her books, The Language of God in History and The Language of God in Prophecy, which show the connection of the gospel in the stars or sacred astronomy to the end times and the Mayan date for the end of the world. The star gospel is the missing key, according to Helena, that shows the true meaning behind symbolism in the Bible, prophecies, and various celestial signs that will soon occur in relation to end-time events. Helena also says one of these signs will occur on the Mayan date for the end of the world in 2012, which is tied to the Book of Revelations, Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Helena also links the pyramids at Giza in Egypt and the pyramids in Mexico to the righteous Sethites who lived before and after the flood. Edge UK Studio co-host Roderick Purser and myself spoke to Helena earlier on this week. Hello, welcome to Edge Thursday Reports Talkback. In the studio, my special guest is Helena Lehman with my co-host Roderick Purser. We're going to talk about 2012 and the Nephilim and any subject that's connected to it. But just a reminder, Helena was on Daniel Ott's live show last Saturday, and if anybody missed that interview, they can go to that page at www.theedgeam.com. The archive is there for you to listen to or watch. Helena is author of books such as The Language of God in Prophecy, The Language of God in the Universe, The Language of God in History, and The Language of God in Humanity. Helena, thank you very much indeed for coming on to Edge Thursday Reports Talkback.
Delighted to be involved and looking forward to talking with you tonight.
Yeah, just in case some viewers and listeners missed Daniel Ott's live show on Saturday, can you just explain about yourself, please?
I'm the author of four books in the Language of God book series. It's over 2,500 pages of very intensely researched information. It's been illustrated, it's indexed, it has a bibliography, an extensive one. And it's taken me 10 years to complete the series. And in the process of writing them and doing all the research I've done for them, which actually took much longer than the writing of the books, I've become an expert in a great deal of subjects, including the Nephilim, the antediluvian history based on books like the Book of Jasher, the Book of Enoch, and the Book of Jubilees, including the Bible. And I have a really sound grasp of the gospel and the stars or sacred astronomy, which is how the Sethites learned about God prior to the flood. And that's what my expertise lies in, is deciphering Bible prophecies using the gospel and the stars. The symbolic imagery in that is tied to many Bible prophecies. And it's really a fascinating subject. And it really ties into 2012, and that's one of the amazing things I'd like to talk about tonight.
Yeah, we want to talk about 2012, but to get the ball rolling on 2012, what are your thoughts on 2012 regarding the Mayan prophecy and other prophecies? We had a show last week on Edge Thursday Reports with Dr. Lynn Marzulli talking about 2012, and this more or less continues that subject.
Right.
So what is your thoughts on 2012?
Well, the interesting thing about it is in my book, The Language of God and History, which just came out this past fall 2009, I talk about the history of the Antediluvians and also into patriarchal age and up almost to modern times. I talk about, you know, the history of the biblical history. And one of the things I focus on in there is the fact that the Mayan civilization is connected to Noah and Shem. In fact, it's highly connected to Noah because in my book I show how it is connected to him. And the fact is that the Mayan calendar may have actually originated not with Noah but with Enoch himself because of the date of the calendar, which is, I think it's 3114 B.C. is when their calendar starts. And that's right when Enoch was about 250 years old and he was still on the earth. He hadn't been translated yet. And Noah was a man who, according to some scriptures, like in the book of Enoch, he was a hermit. He didn't associate with people much. He stayed separate from them, along with Methuselah, toward the end, just before the flood. And because of that hermit nature of his, he wanted to settle on a part of the earth which was further away from, you know, the rest of civilization. And it is possible that he settled in the New World, either prior to the flood or after the flood. And the Aztec calendar stone that they found buried at Tehotihuacan is tied to end time prophecy. And, of course, the date, the end date for the end of the world is marked by that calendar, but also that they said was the end of the world. And it's also tied to the Pacific Ocean Basin, which is one of the fascinating things I reveal in my book, The Language of God and History. But to be specific, I really believe the Mayan civilization originally was a Sethite, a righteous Sethite civilization that was corrupted after the flood by the Nephilim, or the Anakim that survived the flood and intermarried, you know, with humanity. And they corrupted that society and turned it into a very bloodthirsty one, obviously, with the human sacrifice and everything else that was associated with it that was demonic. And but the original date for that calendar came from Enoch, who was a righteous man of God, and I believe that the Great Pyramid at Giza and also the pyramids at Teotihuacan were built by the righteous Sethites. I think the ones at Teotihuacan were probably built after the flood by Noah and his kin, you know, the ones that went with Noah, not his sons. His sons stayed in Europe and Africa. But, you know, Noah, I think, went to the New World. And the Nephilim, and, you know, obviously came in later, probably with Nimrod and his society, which took over the world at one time. He was a world dictator, Nimrod was, and he was dead set against God. His whole religion was anti-Christ, you know, it was anti-God. And he would have, you know, tried to destroy Noah's civilization for sure because it was a bastion of righteousness at that time.
Right. Can we just touch on the antediluvian part and the antediluvian peoples, namely the major cataclysms the Earth is supposed to have gone through thousands and thousands of years ago? Now, in the ancient Hindu religions, in all ancient religions, these cataclysms seem to sort of match at the same time period.
Right.
Don't they? So did, you know, do you think these religions were instigated or led or controlled by Nephilim, fallen angel?
Actually, I've got an interesting theory I discuss in my books, which I have a lot of collaboration on this with. There was a fellow who wrote a book called The Parthenon Code, and I actually forgot the name of the author right now, but he's got a fascinating book out, and he talks about how the Parthenon in Greece, carvings that were covered the top lintels of the structure above the columns, you know, all the carvings that were up there, actually told the history of the world according to Greek mythology. And it all ties in quite well with what the biblical record is, only from the attitude of Cain rather than Seth. It shows the opposing view. And so the religion of, the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, the ancient Egyptians, after the flood, was corrupted with this completely different ideology and focus and emphasis, which was on man instead of God. And so it became very humanistic. And prior to the flood, I really believe there was a monotheistic element in the world that was corrupted. And it started with the gospel and the stars, which was created, obviously, by God himself when he created the universe. He created the constellations, and he gave them meaning by naming the stars and everything. So the Sethites understood the message, and the angels, the good angels, understood the message in the stars, and that it showed the... God already foreknew what was going to happen. He knew Satan was going to fall. He knew Eve was going to bite the forbidden fruit, and, all these things. So that was all in the gospel and the stars already. And so they already had a window into the future, but Adam and Eve didn't know that yet. That came later. They learned about it. And then, Enoch was the first one, I think, to really understand it fully. But Seth...
Yeah. I tell you what I'd like to get into, because unlike the live show, we have limited time on this.
Okay.
I would like to get into the Nephilim, and have you any idea of their input into modern day society? Do they still have this controlling influence?
Well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist extraordinaire, but I will tell you that the Nephilim did survive the flood. They intermarried with humanity, and there was an element of them that survived the Israelite invasion of Canaan, because that's where they had settled, obviously to thwart God's plan for Abraham. And, the Israelites came in there, and they slaughtered most of the giants that lived in Canaan, but they missed a few. And those giants lived on. Where they settled is up for debate, but what we do know is that they were very powerful and strong, and because of that, they got into the royal houses and, became great men of valor and renown, and they obviously had a great deal of power and wealth, and I believe that they have maintained that position in society ever since.
Because it is said they mated with the the bloodline, well, not the bloodlines, the women of the earth, didn't they?
Yeah.
So if that being the case, the offspring and the future generations and their bloodlines will still be around today. So
yes, and that's why some people tie them to the Illuminati, the secret organizations that are controlling what's going on in the world today, and the Freemasons and things like that. Like I said, I'm not an expert on those societies, but I do know that the Nephilim may have infiltrated them and may, in fact, be running them.
What's your feelings on a reptilian input?
Well, you'll love my books for that. Anyone interested in the reptilian element would love my books, because I really firmly believe that the museums of the earth are filled with remains of those reptilians, and those are the dinosaurs. I don't believe dinosaurs existed billions or millions of years ago. I believe they were contemporaneous with mankind prior to the flood, and that the flood destroyed them all, and that's why God brought on the flood, because these Nephilim were very evil. Not only the humanoid ones that were part angel and part human, but the ones that were genetically created, according to Enoch, there was, and Jasher, the book of Jasher, there was genetic splicing going on prior to the flood. Yeah. And these creatures were created through that genetic manipulation, and we're doing the same thing today as in the days of Noah. today because we're messing with genetics the way we are.
Even the international symbol for medical reasons is a serpent, isn't it?
Yeah, and it represents, it's two serpents intertwined over, mm-hmm. and it represents the DNA strand. That's pretty obvious.
Evidence there's a lot of reptilian symbolism in modern-day society, namely with Western powers. For example, MI5 has a reptilian symbol.
Okay, I don't know what that is, but there are... in my book, I talk about it, my Language of God and History book that just came out, I talk about the serpent. There were two, ideologies prior to the flood and afterward. One was called the Way of Yahweh, and that's the way that Yeshua talked about when he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And there was also the way of Cain, or the way of the serpent, because Cain followed the serpent, obviously. He didn't follow God. And that it also ties in with the fact that it was Cain's line, the women of Cain's line, that married into the, angelic line. And, the angels took from the line of Cain, and the first Nephilim that were born from the line of Cain.
Rod, have you got a question?
Well, I'm just in awe, actually, at what all she's saying, because it really seems to fit.
Yeah, my book is revolutionary. It covers ground that no other book prior to it has, and I have a lot of proof for all of this stuff. It's not just something I made up. And I've also had the collaboration of God Himself with the Holy Spirit giving me guidance through the entire writing period of working on these books. So it was a divine appointment, so to speak. And there's a lot of prophetic information that I've revealed in these books because it's time. The Book of Enoch says it was written for a time, far into the future, and that's now. And I'm one of the people that God has given knowledge about it to, break the code, so to speak, so that it can benefit humanity as we go into the tribulation period, which is very near. And actually, the 2012 date, the Nephilim may be involved. In fact, on December 21st, 2012, it may be that's when they arrive in their, interplanetary spaceships, so to speak, if they, have that sort of technology, and I suspect they do, because of some of the things I've heard, recently about the astronauts seeing UFOs and things like that. But, if that is true, that is very possible that the great deception that's going to come upon the world is these Nephilim returning and claiming that they're angelic beings supporting the Antichrist. And I do believe the Antichrist is going to be human. He's not going to be a Nephilim. Some people think he's going to be Nephilim, but I don't think so. He has to be like Christ. Christ was not Nephilim. He's an Antichrist, so he's got to be the opposite of Christ, but he's still human. You know what I mean? As far as ideology, he's different. And this December 21st, 2012 date that's marked by the Mayan calendar is really significant because on that day, there's four zodiac signs that have all these major planets lined up in them. And those four zodiac signs are tied to the four horsemen of the apocalypse, which I prove in detail in my book, The Language of God and Prophecy. There's four zodiac signs tied to each one of the horses, and the riders. For example, the rider on the black horse is carrying some scales, represents Libra. And then you have the rider on the pale horse associated with scorpions and serpents in the text. And that one obviously represents Scorpio. And then there's the rider on the white horse carrying a bow. That represents Sagittarius. And the rider on the red horse is bringing war and violence and everything. The rider on the red horse is Taurus, because Taurus is the bull charging, to attack, his enemy. And Orion is like if you look at the stars in heaven, you'll see Orion and Taurus next to each other, and they're actually tied to the Messiah, and they represent a lot of things about the Messiah and his first coming and also his second coming. But they also relate to what's going on the earth at the same time. And Taurus signifies the enemies of God coming to kill, you know, God's servants. And in this case, Orion represents Yeshua, you know, and the great confrontation that comes at the Battle of Armageddon. So that Taurus the bull is charging Orion, which represents Christ, and trying to kill him, obviously. So,
Helena, do you think the future is actually set in stone, or do we have a choice?
I believe that we always have a choice, but God already foreknew what our choices would be. You understand? I don't believe in predestination in the sense that, in Calvinistic predestination. I believe that we all have choices that we make freely, and God is not orchestrating our choices. But I do believe that God already knew the beginning from the end, and he knew what to interject into our history to get the desired result. You know what I mean? Because God knows everything. It's impossible for us to comprehend that, but he knows everything. He already knew what was going to happen and transpire. He knew that I'd be talking to you tonight. I mean, he knew all these things.
Yep. Yeah, can I come back to the 2012 thing?
Sure.
Yeah. There are commentators out there that claim and say that this whole 2012 scenario could be a fallen angel agenda to instigate fear into the public. As some people state, if many minds are worried or scared about one subject, that can actually manipulate the future on a quantum level. So, what would your answer be to the 2012 fear agenda being part of a deception?
I think that you're talking about quantum physics right now, and the whole idea that our thoughts our thinking can affect the future. I personally believe that you can take something too far. And I don't believe that, you know, if the New Agers had it their way, all the people that are New Age in the societies we live in today, who have been, you know, ushering in this great awakening and change, if they had their way, then the rapture is going to happen because they don't need us anymore because we're defective, right? And then they're going to take over the world and make it a beautiful, wonderful place where tolerance is the norm and sin is celebrated and everything else. That is going to happen. But it isn't the ultimate outcome, even though they are going to think that. And all of these New Agers today that are going to be left behind after the, you know, the rapture are going to be thinking that. Are they going to get their way? Is the world going to transform itself into a New Age paradigm shift, you know, and Christianity will never again be on Earth. Some people actually believe that, but I don't. God made Earth as our habitation, and we will return with Christ and take over the Earth, and the New Ager society, so to speak, is going to be it's no longer going to exist. And there are all of those positive thinking and their meditations and rituals trying to usher in this new age are going to be for naught because God's going to have his way, and it certainly isn't the new age way.
Yeah. Have you heard of an organization, Helena, called the Holographic Council?
No.
No, we're just investigating that for future shows. I was just wondering if you did. It's worth the research into it. You might be surprised of what they do, and you would like to comment on that, I'm sure. But on Saturday night show, you mentioned something about Hawaii being connected to the pyramid energies or an anti-energy of the pyramid.
Well, you know, the Great Pyramid at Giza is tied to Al-Nitak, right? And so are the other two pyramids at Giza. They're connected to the three belt stars of Orion, which represents our Savior and our Messiah, Yeshua. And so it represents his belt of righteousness. And it represents the three crosses on Calvary. And at Teotihuacan, we see the same symbolism. We see the three pyramids lined up to represent Orion's belt, with the pyramid of the sun, of course, representing the pyramid the pyramid of Khafre at Giza, the middle pyramid, which represents Yeshua, and then the temple to Quetzalcoatl represents the Great Pyramid of Giza, that represents the church or the bride of Christ, and then you have the pyramid of the moon, which is tied to the pyramid of Menkaure, which represents the fallen sinners that never really repent, and it's also tied to the crucifixion, because the middle cross obviously represents Yeshua dying on the cross for our sins, his shed blood being the thing that's needed to be forgiven and to be able to enter heaven with it and be before God as a pure being. And then you have the pyramid at Giza, the Great Pyramid, and then you have the Temple to Quetzalcoatl, who are tied to the Bride of Christ. And they also were tied to the robber who repented on the cross next to Christ. He asked him for forgiveness and wanted to be with him in his kingdom. And Yeshua gave him the promise that there were many mansions in heaven and he would be up there in paradise with him. And the other robber obviously did not repent. He, mocked Christ and made fun of him. And that represents a segment of humanity that will be left behind during the tribulation period to be cleansed in the fire of the tribulation, you know, the trouble of the tribulation. And they, too, may, end up saved, but it'll be as through the fire. They're going to be refined in the fire of the tribulation.
Yeah. Rod, do you have a question?
I did earlier. There's recently we've had the spiral in Norway. We've also had a similar anomaly in the sky. What was it, in Thailand? And then, from what I understand, one in Russia. And, recently there's been reports of some type of vortex off the coast of Yemen now. And to back that on up even a little further, Gilgamesh's tomb was found at the bottom of the Euphrates River. And,
What did you find?
The tomb of Gilgamesh, which some say was Nimrod, was, there was reports that it was recovered.
Okay, yeah, no, I haven't heard that yet. But that's interesting, considering there's a abyss that's opened in that region, and all these demons come out of it in the Book of Revelation.
According to a recent interview, I think it was on Project Camelot, there was a gentleman telling about a vortex of water in that region that's, it's spinning, and there's warships from every country on the planet in that region for some reason.
Well, they say that the Euphrates is going to dry up and allow the kings of the east to attack, in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So that's possible that, it has something to do with that. But it also has to do with the fact that there is an abyss that these four angels are sent down to open. And once they open it, all these demons come out, this army of 200 million. In my book, I suggest that it's possible that these demons will inhabit the bodies of Nephilim that are either on the earth now or being created in some part of the universe and are going to be brought back here either in spaceships or are already on the earth somewhere, maybe in an underground cavern or somewhere in the Gobi Desert in China, because that's where they're going to come from, according to scripture with the kings of the east. So it's very interesting, how it all may play out, but there is an abyss there near near Babylon, I believe, and the Euphrates River. And if they found the tomb of Gilgamesh, he was described as a giant in that story. So if I don't think it was Nimrod himself, because he was human, as far as I know, but it's possible he was one of his one of his sons. It could have been his son, Marduk, I think he was called, or Marmon, or something like that. He had a name similar to Marduk, and he may be the Nimrod's son, may have been the person behind the deity, Marduk, that the Babylonians worshipped.
We've had some interesting phenomena since Christmas. We've had these spiral things, UFOs or missiles, whatever they were, or single spiral over Norway. And, of course, Scandinavia is where...
Yeah, I saw that. It was interesting. I did some research about it, but I found that it really wasn't all that significant as far as the gospel and the stars went, so I pretty much just overlooked it for now because...
We were trying to connect the dots on these events in previous shows.
Right. It could have something to do with secret, space... stuff that's going on with the, space programs of various countries we don't know about. And it could be, I think they did say it was some kind of debris from something, satellite or...
So you think these spirals are not connected in any way to 2012 or any sort of portals or vortex? Right, okay.
What really connects to a lot of the signs in the heaven that Yeshua spoke of in the Bible, the Bible's filled with prophecies that are being fulfilled today, obviously. And Yeshua told his disciples to watch for the signs in the heavens prior to his coming, including when he said that when the sun became when the moon became as blood and the sun became as sackcloth, he was talking about solar eclipses and lunar eclipses. And many of the solar and lunar eclipses coming up in the near future are tied to major Jewish feasts. So they are, indicative of the fact that, Jacob's trouble is coming, that many things are going to happen surrounding Israel, and obviously the war of Gog and Magog and Armageddon are going to be centered in the Middle East. So, God is really in control here. I mean, in a sense, he is. He knows the beginning from the end. He knows the end. He knows the future. He knows what everything's going to happen. And he's already got his plans in place. And his will be done regardless of what any human being thinks. Because the only human beings whose will be done are the children of God, because that's who Yeshua, he gives the people that believe in him and love him and are following him today the right to be children of God, the right to have the authority that Christ has over demons and over the future and over what happens today. And since we are of like mind with Christ, then of course God's will is going to be done regardless of whatever the New Agers think.
All right, I'm going to be devil's advocate here, as I always pitch in a devil's advocate question. What of the atheist who is a kind and gentle person, who helps people voluntarily, who goes out of their way to be loving to other people, who puts themselves first beyond anything else, but they're not a believer, they're an atheist? Does God have any room in his heart for those people?
Well, there is a last judgment, okay? Those people may not be taken in the, obviously they're going to be left behind during the rapture. And I believe there's two raptures during the tribulation period, one in the middle and one at the beginning, or just before. And the people that are left behind, the person you're describing there, I have a dear friend who is an atheist who... really doesn't have any desire to know God. And interestingly enough, he has a brother who's quite religious, but he is not. And he's this dear, sweet person. He wouldn't hurt a fly. He goes out of his way to do wonderful things for people. He's very intelligent, and he's been a wonderful friend. And I just dread the thought of him having to live through the tribulation, but he may have to because he doesn't believe in Yeshua.
Perhaps there are people that are meant to live through these tribulation periods.
Well, of course,
people like that can help other people.
Well, they're also going to be saved. That's the ultimate purpose of the tribulation, is to bring many, many millions to the cross and to be saved and to be able to live eternity with God instead of living eternity with Satan and hell. So,
what would you say to the kind, gentle Buddhist and the kind, gentle Muslim?
If they don't believe in Yeshua HaMashiach, They will be judged at the last judgment, and God will decide where they go. And it depends on how they feel about Christ, who they will see living and standing there as their judge, and how they respond to him. And if they don't want to accept him as their Savior and as their ultimate God, then they will perish. That is what the Bible teaches, and that is exactly what God is going to do. There is not everyone goes to heaven. I'm sorry, that's just not the case.
They will perish even if they've done no harm to anybody, and they will perish.
Everybody has done harm. Everyone is filled with sin. We all deserve to die. That's the problem with humanity today. This wishy-washy, I've never sinned, I'm a good person, I don't hurt anybody, I don't deserve to go to hell. That's baloney. We all deserve to go to hell. We've all fallen. We've all sinned. We've all lied, cheated, stealed. You know, cheated on our
Yes, yes, you're absolutely right.
I mean, I'm guilty of sin just like everyone else, and I have to go to the foot of the cross and ask Christ for forgiveness, or I will perish in hell. And that is the truth for every single human being on this planet, regardless of the religion they're in now, because Yeshua reaches through barriers like that to try and get their attention. He has done it numerous times in the Middle East today. I've heard reports from Joel Rosenberg and others that there are many people coming to Christ because they're having visions and dreams, and Yeshua is appearing to them and saying that they need to get out of Babylon, that they need to get out of the false religions that they're in. And it's happening. There's underground churches in China and India, and many, unfortunately, martyrs dying in those countries because of the hatred toward Christianity there is today. But there are, you know, and you're saying that these people are exonerated, even though they're killing all the Christians.
No, I was being devil's advocate.
Well, you're obviously, but I'm just telling you that it's really a sad situation. You've got all of these people who are dying as martyrs in these countries, but they're still coming to Christ, even though they know they could die as martyrs. They would prefer to die a Christian than die in a false religion. And that is it. You know, it's a wonderful thing that God is reaching out to these people today. But unfortunately, we live in a world that is antagonistic to Christianity and will do anything to kill Christianity and shut them up. And they're doing it here in America. Now it's shutting us up, and they've done it around the world as far as persecution, you know, extraordinary piece of persecution toward anyone who's a Christian. In Muslim,
I've got to ask another devil's advocate question.
Sure, go ahead.
Talking about being antagonistic towards Christians, I mean, Christianity itself has a checkered past. You've only got to
look
at
the Christians living in China don't have anything to do with that past. The Christians living in Africa have nothing to do with that past. You're talking about the Roman Catholic Church. You're talking about the Inquisition and all of the wars that were fought in the name of Christ that were totally, you know, evil and wrong. And, including the Crusades to some extent. You know, a lot of them were really ruthless wars about money and power more than they were about anything to do with God.
Yeah.
But that is the Roman Catholic Church. That is not that does not represent the majority of Christianity today, which broke away from the Catholic Church in 1517. When Luther nailed his 95 theses on the door of the Gutenberg Church.
Just to not be devil's advocate. Uh-huh. Yeah, I had a guest on Thursday Reports early on last year, and he was part of a mission in I think it was India. It was in India, and part of a persecuted Christian mission, and he came out with some horrendous horror stories, and he's had to remain anonymous now because his family had death threats. So yeah, I know the persecution. Yeah,
was that the one that you took off?
That's the one we had to take off air because the gentleman was getting death threats. Yeah.
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah, yeah, and it's also going on in China and it's in India and China and. Any place where the Muslims have a stronghold right now, Christians are being persecuted and killed.
These weren't actually Muslims. This was Chinese backed, actually.
Of course, atheists hate. China. Obviously, atheists hate Chinese. You know, hate Christians too. It's really sad how look at how Russia killed millions of Christians. When Stalin took control 22 million people died. They weren't all Jew, obviously. They were, most of them were Christians when he took over.
Well, all religious denominations got persecuted under Stalin.
Of course,
the
majority of them were Christians.
Let's go back to 2012. Have you got further thoughts on 2012? I mean, I don't think it's the end of the world.
I think it's the beginning of the end. And I don't think there is ever going to be an end of the world. God has made it our habitation, and it will exist forever in one state or another. The new heaven and new earth are obviously a recreation of heaven and earth as we know today. So earth will continue, and we will dwell on earth. But so I don't believe that the world's ever going to end. So it is really the coming of a new age, as the New Agers talk about it, but it's the new age of the millennial rule of Christ, and then after that, eternity with God. And at least in 2012, what I see happening is the rapture happening this year sometime. I have proof of that in my book, that it's very possible it could happen this year. And it's tied to the prophecies in the Psalms. Psalms 110 through 118 are very prophetic for this time period in history. If that's true, then the tribulation would begin sometime in 2011, tied to the Jewish year 5771. And it's interesting to note that the seventh year in this period is 5777, and the 777 obviously represents the finality and completion of God's plan. So, and that would be when Yeshua returns, at the end of the tribulation period, which I think is going to be in 2017. I believe he will return in that year. And the tribulation will end. He may return before then, though, because it says that if he didn't cut it short, no life would be left on earth. That life, mankind would literally wipe himself out. And, of course, obviously with help from the Nephilim, probably. But that, I see that scenario coming up in 2012 where the great deception is going to occur, and there's going to be great war on the earth and destruction. And also the pestilences that pour out on the earth are from God himself, divine pestilences, not originating with mankind, that are going to cause horrendous destruction and death during the tribulation period.
I have a question.
Yes.
In your book and also on your website, I was reading one of your PDFs, I think it was Come Up Hither or something of that nature.
Yeah, come up here and come away. Yeah. It's my new article about the rapture and the second coming.
Well, I noticed that you had listed some potential significant dates for this year. And I was wondering if maybe you could just start from January and run us through December with just a brief...
Briefly, the ones that I really think we need to pay attention to are the Jupiter-Uranus conjunctions in Pisces this year. And the first one is on June 6th. And the second one is on September 22nd. And then there's also a solar eclipse on July 11th, 2010, very significantly tied to the wedding of the Lamb, Yeshua and his bride. And so is Jupiter, the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction, because Jupiter represents the Messiah as well. And Uranus represents the bride of Christ. And the fact that they're going to be in conjunction on these two dates, which are very close to Jewish holidays, is very significant. And I believe that they're tied to the rapture, because if you look in the heavens and you look where Jupiter and Uranus line up, they line up over the back of the fish, which represents Christianity, that's on the ecliptic, the fish of Pisces, that's on the ecliptic. There's one that's traveling away from the ecliptic, the path the sun travels on, and one that's right on the ecliptic. And the Jupiter and Uranus are obviously just above that fish, on the ecliptic. And then if you look at it from the standpoint of Easter Island, which is very significant in history, in the Star Gospel, I talk about that in my book as well, the fact that Easter Island is indicated as a spot that the Sethites marked off as important because of the solar, because of the celestial events that will be seen best from Easter Island, and this solar eclipse is one of them. And anyway, if you go to Easter Island and stand and look at the sky on July 11th when the solar eclipse occurs, that night you will see Jupiter and Uranus. Actually, you would need a telescope to see Uranus because it's invisible to the naked eye, which is why it's connected to the Bride of Christ, which is an invisible thing right now. But you'll see them right over the back of the fish, over the back of Pegasus, the horse, the white horse, in the celestial signs that represented the mount that Perseus used to rescue Andromeda. And Pegasus actually represents the white horse that Yeshua is going to use to return to Earth and rescue his church, Andromeda representing. Actually, Andromeda represents the Jews. It represents the Jews that are tied to the law. Because Andromeda is tied to this rock and she can't get away. Obviously, she's trapped. So, and that's why they're left behind. And when Yeshua returns at the second coming, he'll come for Andromeda. Prior to that, though, he's going to come first for his church. And Jupiter and Uranus over the Pisces fish, which represents the church, is over the back of Pegasus, which represents Christ's horse, his white horse, and his second, his coming in the rapture and then again in the second coming. So it's very fascinating that these signs are occurring now. The I know that there have been Jupiter and Uranus conjunctions before in Pisces, but never in this particular location, dead center in the fish above the on the ecliptic that represents church, the Church of Christ, the Bride of Christ.
Well, one other question I have for you, if you've got time, just to throw a name or an association out there. Tell me about the Pleiades. I know they're mentioned in the book of Job. But what significant role do you see?
The Pleiades is basically like a star cluster of seven stars, or six stars now, actually, riding on the back of Taurus the bull. Mm-hmm. And that Taurus the bull, in this case, represents the beast out of the sea, represents that beast. Which is the nations of Europe, uniting with the Arab nations in one giant conglomerate under the Antichrist. And they're going to surround Jerusalem, at the end. But that's the beast out of the sea. And the woman riding the beast is the churches. The seven churches of Revelation are the ones that Christ talked about in the beginning. Six of those churches are left behind. One is taken to heaven. That's the Church of Philadelphia, who goes through the open door. And the rest of the churches left behind to live through the tribulation, some of whom are going to become the whore of Babylon, who rides on the back of the beast, the harlot that has the blood of the martyrs in her cup. And that is obviously connected to the Roman Catholic Church and their ecumenical movement. It's all in the stars. It's all been mapped out, and it's interesting that on 2012, Taurus is figured prominently as one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Okay, very interesting. We've come towards the end of time, I'm afraid, Helena.
Yes, and it literally, as well as with this, with this conversation, it's also literally happening in our world
synchronicity
today.
Synchronicity. That's right. I'd like to thank you very much indeed for coming on to my show. You've been absolutely fantastic. But before we go, do you want to mention your website?
Sure.
You've got a DVD in the pipeline?
I do have a DVD in the pipeline. It's called the Orion Code. It talks about the fact that the Orion's Belt is marked at these two locations on the Earth, and how significant that is in history, and how it's connected to the end times, and the Great Tribulation, and also the Second Coming. And that'll be ready probably by the end of February, early March, maybe mid-March by the latest that it'll be out. But also, I have a fascinating website people can go to read excerpts from my books, and I have a lot of free articles they can download. And it's called PillarOfEnoch.com. That's PillarOfEnoch.com. Or you can just type in my name. It's Helena Lehman. That's HelenaLehman.com. And that'll take you to my website. And I have a bookstore there. You can actually buy all my books from there. And before then, you can get a really good feel for what they're all about by reading the various pages and excerpts that I have on the website, and I encourage people that are interested in the subject to take a look, because you're going to find information there that you won't find anywhere else.
Really?
Can the Edge UK studio have a review copy of your DVD when it's released?
Sure. I'd be happy to send you one. Just give me your address after the show and send it to me email or something, and I'll be happy to mail you one when it's ready.
That's very kind of you.
I'd love to kind of talk about it, too, when it's finished.
Yes, you'll be coming back on the show to talk about it. I'm afraid now we've run out of time for this show, so just to remind viewers and listeners, you'll be listening to Helena Lehman talking about her books, 2012, The Nephilim, and much, much more. In the UK studio, Roderick Purser has been my co-host. Again, Helena, thank you very much indeed.
Good night, gentlemen, and thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you, Helena.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
EBN's UK studio.
Welcome back. My name is Andy Radford, and this is Edge Thursday Reports, coming to you from the Edge's UK studio. And if you as a viewer want to take part in an Edge talkback discussion and question a guest, please get in touch with me, andy@theedgeam.com. That's andy@theedgeam.com. You will be able to come on air and question the guest also. Well, that about wraps up the show for this week, but just a quick reminder about Daniel Ott's live show this Saturday night, February the 6th, 2010, which starts at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Daniel is interviewing Jeffrey Grupp. The Illuminati are the Nephilim, according to him. Now, that's Daniel Ott's live show, February the 6th, 2010, which starts at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'd like to thank Dr. Frederick Meekins, Roderick Purser, and of course my special guest in Edge Thursday Reports Talkback, Helena Lehman. Don't forget to take a look at the Edge's new web store where you can buy Helen's books and much, much more. My name is Andy Radford, your host for Edge Thursday Reports, coming to you from the Edge's UK studio. Thank you very much indeed for tuning in, and until next week, goodbye. We'll be right back.